Welcome to the PreparedX Podcast, your complete source for crisis, emergency, business continuity, and security preparedness interviews, news, and much more. Now, your host, he creates chaos for a living, Rob Burton.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 6 of the PreparedX Podcast. This is an interview with Marisa Randazzo of Sigma Threat Management Associates. Sigma is a partnership of experts in behavioral threat assessment, threat management, and violence prevention. They train clients how to build and operate threat assessment teams and programs, helping them develop their own ability to assess and manage threatening situations in accordance with best practices. Marisa is a Princeton graduate, and she's also served with the Secret Service. I've known Marisa for almost 10 years now. It's been almost 10 years. Wow. And she's a pleasure to work with. So this is going to be a good one. Within this interview, we did get talking a lot about threat management and how businesses and why businesses should create programs to protect their employees and their customers from workplace violence situations. And so some real good case studies that she talks about in here, as well as other good tools and good ways to set these programs up. I think we can all do more when it comes to protecting our staff and customers. And Marisa and her associates are one of the best in terms of developing these programs. Anyway, that's enough of me. Here's the interview. Welcome, Marisa. How are you doing today?
Great, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. I'm pleased that you could take some time out to be on this podcast with us today. We're really excited for this one.
Oh, thanks. It's really a pleasure to be here talking with you.
Before we get going, I know we have some questions to ask you. Before we get going, though, if just for the audience here at PreparedX, could you just give them a few minutes on your background and how you got to this point in your career today?
Sure. So the company I'm with right now is a company I created along with Gene Deisinger, and our company is called Sigma Threat Management Associates. And essentially what we do is we've got a team of 12 folks who are all experts in various aspects of behavioral threat assessment and threat management. So we help schools and corporations and colleges and universities and some certain high-profile families to evaluate threats when they receive them, whether it's a threat that comes in by email, something that's posted on social media, something that's said in person, something that comes in anonymously. We help them figure out if there's anything to it, if it's a credible threat, and if so, what we can do to reduce that threat, to mitigate risk, and to prevent any violence or harm from occurring. Before I started Sigma, I was actually with the U.S. Secret Service for 10 years, and my last position there was as their chief research psychologist. And essentially, I did very similar work for the Secret Service that I'm doing now with Sigma. I would help on various investigations into threats to the president, to the first family, to the first children, to visiting heads of state when they were in the U.S. And we also got a chance to conduct some fascinating research along with the U.S. Department of Education into school shootings across the U.S. And from that research, really helped to craft a school threat assessment model that's been widely promoted as best practice for preventing school violence. And we now use it for preventing campus violence as well.
That's great. And what we'd like to do as part of the notes section in the podcast here, we'll add some links in that where people and our listeners can get more information on those various programs and systems that you've been involved in.
Great. Thanks.
And so I think that leads straight in really to a lot of the businesses that we work with around helping them prepare for a variety of different crises, be it natural disasters, man-made threats, you know, some of the kind of technological failure where it impacts their operations. They're always looking at these different scenarios that they try to pull together. And so sometimes those scenarios as well could be threatening happening scenarios that would active shooter being quite popular, believe it or not, or actually, you know, in today's society, with the threat of ISIS and with other threats that exist, both here in the States and overseas, I think it's you know, quite relevant at the moment. And so they prepare for those in a number of ways. So from your standpoint, though, and what from the work that you do, why is it important for those organizations, be it an educational institute, be it a business or other kind of entity, why is it important for them to understand the physical threats that they may face?
Well, one thing that's absolutely critical is we know that there are corporations, there are schools, there are colleges, there are individual people who do face threatening situations, and we have an obligation, especially for workplaces, to make sure that we are creating, promoting, and sustaining safe workplaces. So if we want to just use the workplace example, or even to think about a college or a university or as a school, as an employer as well as an educational institution, if we take workplace safety, for example, workplace safety is not just about making sure equipment runs the right way and there aren't slippery floors and you don't have hazardous conditions. It's really also about looking at behavior and finding ways to be able to address behavior that raises some fear and raises some concern. So, you know, in the course of a given week, we will work with corporations largely to handle ongoing situations where they're worried about a particular employee. The employee all of a sudden seems like they're not doing well. Maybe they seem like they're showing a change in physical appearance. Maybe they're talking about feeling more desperate. Maybe they are what people know of as a disgruntled employee, or maybe there's someone that they need to terminate or need to discipline from an HR perspective, but they're worried about how this person's going to react. They're worried about, are they going to become violent in the meeting? Are they going to go home and get a weapon and come back and engage in violence here? Because we don't have workplaces that are, you know, hardened targets, they're not bunkers, they're not military facilities.
Right.
We have open workplaces and campuses, so we need to be able to take other steps to address behavior when it raises concern. And that's where my line of work comes in terms of workplace threat assessment as part of a workplace violence prevention program.
Sure.
Rob, let me add one thing, too. There's also a national standard that many people may not be aware of. It was approved by the American National Standards Institute, or ANSI, as it's known. It was actually created by both the American Society for Industrial Security, so by security folks, as well as by HR folks, as the Society for Human Resource Management. And that national standard is a national standard for workplace violence prevention programs and threat management programs. And essentially, national standard says every major workplace should have a multidisciplinary team made up of security and HR and employee assistance and legal counsel who can get together when some employee's behavior raises concern. Or if you have an employee who had to get a restraining order against their former spouse and the spouse knows they can always find that employee at your workplace. So there are ways that we can address this behavior, and the national standard helps to set out some clear guidance as to what those should look like in terms of best practice.
Great. Yeah, I think that's important information. And again, we can add that into the show notes. And so as we walk through this, then, in terms of individuals that pose threats to those groups that we mentioned, be it a school, be it a business, or some kind of group where they're not a hardened target, it's not a military installation, you know, are there any common behavioral patterns that could potentially be identified prior to a hostile situation, some kind of situation getting worse?
Yeah, absolutely. There are some common behaviors that we look for often, and let me explain where they come from. There's actually been a whole host of very, very important research that's been done on workplace shootings and insider threats to the workplace, on school shootings, on campus shootings, and what is fascinating is that the results from all of those different research studies look remarkably similar. And they essentially say that people who engage in this type of violence, we call it targeted violence, other people call it predatory violence or intended violence, it's essentially violence where someone just doesn't all of a sudden lose their temper and become physical. It's violence where they have given some thought beforehand to who they want to harm, where they want to harm.
Sure.
But essentially, that the common behavior we see across all these is that people who carry out this type of violence do so by following what we call the pathway to violence. So it's a very sort of distinct, and it's a logical and potentially detectable progression of behaviors. So the pathway to violence really has four major components. One is someone comes up with an idea to do harm. And, you know, lots of us, you know, we may have a passing thought here and there about, oh, I really wish I could do such and such to so-and-so, but we don't do anything more with it.
Yep.
The pathway to violence really looks at going from just having that passing thought to having more of a persistent idea of doing some harm, and then going from that idea to developing a plan. How do you want to carry it out? Where could you find them? How do you want to hurt them? Do you have access to the tools, the weapons you need? So that first idea, step is idea. Second step is plan. Third step is acquisition of lethal means. So you have to get a weapon, ammunition, a pipe bomb, whatever lethal means this person is considering, to the place where they want to do harm. So acquiring that means to engage in lethal violence. And then the fourth step is implementation, actually carrying it out itself. When we engage in threat assessment, essentially we are looking at whether the person we're worried about is on this pathway to violence. Do they have an idea to engage in harm? Are they taking steps toward carrying it out through a plan, through acquisition, moving toward implementation? If we think they're on it, our challenge then is to figure out why, because people who engage in this type of violence across these sectors in schools, colleges, workplaces, usually do so because they've got personal problems they can't handle. So if we can figure out what those are and try to help them handle it a different way, we can get them off the pathway to violence, and they stay off the pathway to violence, and that's how we prevent harm.
And so throughout those stages, there are opportunities for not just the professionals to identify various signs, but also there's opportunities for, be it a workplace audience or be it parents at home, if it's a child, you know, there's someone somewhere that potentially has pieces of that information that could help identify and try and ultimately prevent this from taking place. Is that your experience?
Absolutely. And that's one of the key reasons why threat assessment works so well at preventing violence, because someone sees something somewhere. The challenge is we need to make sure that they feel encouraged to then pass that along, to report it to someone in the workplace, someone in their school. One thing we saw in studying school shooters was that the vast majority of school shooters had shared their violent plans and violent ideas with friends and with classmates beforehand. So there were lots of other kids who knew, but the kids didn't necessarily know what to do with it. They don't want to get their friend into trouble. Maybe the friend is joking. They don't want to overreact. One thing we've seen workplaces and schools and colleges do really well recently is send out the message that it doesn't matter what role you play in this organization, doesn't matter if you're a young student, a new employee, a temp, a vendor, whatever it is, you may be the first person to see something concerning. And if you see it, pass it along. So it gets back to that, if you see something, say something. And then the threat assessment process can kick in and people can gather information and figure out, is this person thinking about planning for violence? If so, why? What are the personal issues going on? How do we help solve them a different way?
Yeah, and it could be that smallest piece of information, right, that could just be part of something that either triggers and starts that discussion, or it could be something that could be added into an existing, set of data that's already being formed. I think that's great advice.
Yeah, and I think that's the key, too, is that when you see something, you might not know if folks are already worried about this person, but they don't have enough to go on. So that one small piece of information may be the critical piece of the puzzle that they're missing.
Sure. And so that leads into, another question here with regards to, are there any, recent cases that, you can discuss where those common behaviors were identified either after an event had happened or in the build-up to an event and it was, it was stopped? Is there anything recently, either in the news that you can comment on or anything that you've worked on that's, maybe more generic because understanding that, certain situations are, somewhat private or secure?
Sure. I can talk about a couple of cases in the news. And one in particular that got a lot of media attention is involved a student named John Ladue, L-A-D-U-E, so you can Google that one. But it's a great case of a school shooting that wasn't. John was first, someone first notified authorities because they saw John, who's a high school student, at a storage facility at odd hours, and they thought that was strange. They didn't know John. It was just someone who happened to be in the vicinity and called and said to police, I don't know what's going on, but there's someone here, and it doesn't look right, and I'm not sure what's going on. And so police were able to look into what was going on with John, and they started to gather more information that suggested that he was possibly on this pathway to violence. He had been doing a lot of research on the internet about previous school shootings. He was starting to feel like he was identifying with different school shooters. He understood why they did what they did. He felt that he hadn't been treated well, or he had grievances, and he started to see sort of some common themes in some of the other school shooters, not all of them, but some of the others. So he felt like he found people that he could identify with and started to think, well, maybe I'll do what they did. Maybe that helps solve their problems and I'll do the same thing. And he started to create pipe bombs and amass weaponry and was putting them in the storage facility. And so it, as information got to be compiled more and more, the more information that law enforcement in this case gathered, the more concern that they had. And so they talked to John and asked him, what are you doing with this? And John was quite forthcoming and saying, well, this is what I'm thinking about and planning to do. And that's one of the surprising things. When we're talking about individuals who engage in this, I'm not necessarily talking about terrorist groups or terrorist-inspired violence. Sure. But when we're talking about the individuals, the active shooters that we often hear about, they are often quite forthcoming when someone talks to them. And I want to share with you one fascinating thing as to why. I got a chance to interview several school shooters in prison when we were doing this research. The U.S. Secret Service and U.S. Department of Education did our study of school shootings. And in talking with school shooters in prison after they've carried out their school shootings, it was fascinating to hear them describe what really can be characterized as ambivalence about their shooting. So even leading up, thinking about it, planning it, even leading up to that, the morning of their shooting, they felt ambivalent. And what I mean by that is really the classic definition of feeling both that you wanted to and also that you didn't want to at the same time, feeling conflicted about it. And we have talked within this field about, you know, is the fact that school shooters, workplace shooters often tell other people beforehand, is that a way that they're trying to get some attention to this? Is it a cry for help? Is it that they want someone to stop them? Because in a way, once you get that idea out there, they can't just back down on their own. And they wouldn't save face that way. But if someone else stops them, then they don't have to make that decision themselves. And so it was fascinating to hear
prison
interviews about this real ambivalence. Part of me felt like I had to, in the sense of I felt like I had no options left. I felt like there was no other way I could solve my problem. I had tried other ways. I was feeling desperate. I didn't care if I lived anymore. I wanted to die. And at the same time, these school shooters telling us, but I also didn't want to do it, and I was hoping someone would stop me. And I think that's important for people to understand it. When we watch the media, you know, Rob, you watch the media and you think, oh, we're just dealing with psychopaths here, right, or sociopaths, people who have no capacity to care about others, that they're headed toward violence at some point, whether it's now or later, it's just it'll happen. And that's not who these people are.
Right.
These people are often overwhelmed by their personal problems, don't see a way out, and see violence as a viable solution.
Sure. Yeah, that's fascinating. That's a fascinating insight into those school shooters. That's really, amazing. Amazing to hear those stories. From a business standpoint, you mentioned the four, steps or the path that individuals take when they head down that road. But in terms of an organization, identifying those threats, before an attack happens, is there anything they can do to implement some kind of system, or are there tools that they can utilize to really help them, identify and reduce. Obviously, as you mentioned, you're hired, or you know, Sigma's hired on a regular basis to come in on a, you know, very specific cases. But are there things in terms of preparing an organization can do to prepare their, whether it be a security team or a wider audience, including legal, human resources? You mentioned a number of individuals that should be part of that team earlier on. So is other, you know, what kind of system can an organization implement to help them kind of identify those types of threats?
Yeah, well, getting back to that ANSI national standard for workplace violence prevention, that has a great blueprint for different things that companies can look at. But just in terms of the main elements that I think are important are, A, having a multidisciplinary team that is trained to handle threatening situations. And the training you can get from a variety of places, but you want to get good quality training in behavioral threat assessment. That's key. And you want to have folks at the table that include HR, include your security, include your employee assistance program if you've got it, even if it's external. A lot of workplaces have external programs, so it's not someone necessarily in-house, but they can get someone on the phone to come to a meeting every so often. And your legal counsel, either at your meetings on a regular basis or just available to help field legal questions about situations. So to have a multidisciplinary team, make sure they have training, good quality training and assessment, and then have the message out to the workplace that the workplace cares about safety and that everyone who works there can contribute to a safe working environment by reporting concerns as soon as they see them. And making sure people understand this threat assessment program, workplace violence program, whatever the company wants to call its program or its team, that it really is built to help people and help people get to the right resources and the right help that they need so that everyone stays safe. It's not the same as a strictly disciplinary program. And the important message is that the earlier a team like that hears about something, the more likely it is that the majority of what they can do is provide support, and there's very little, you know, punitive or even law enforcement contact that has to be involved.
Right.
But if they don't hear about something until it's very far advanced, they may have to take a punitive measure. They may have to involve law enforcement from a criminal justice standpoint.
Right. Yep. So there's almost a tipping point, probably. Then at what point is there no return? Right.
There can be, but there still is the point. We've worked on situations where someone's been stopped, you know, shortly before they actually carried something out, and even if there is some criminal justice intervention, it's so much better than and so much less cumbersome and burdensome than if they actually had gone through something violent. So
right.
It's still better, even if you stop someone right as they're walking in the door before they actually shoot. It's still feasible, and it's still better overall. One thing we've seen some workplaces do is adopt or implement, rather, anonymous reporting mechanisms. And those can be very helpful. Workplaces may already have something like this in place for whistleblower types of concerns, for Sarbanes-Oxley requirements, things like that. They can either use that or they can adopt something, you know, new in conjunction with those. To encourage people, if you want to share a concern that you have, but you don't feel comfortable identifying yourself,
right,
you don't want your name involved, here's a way you can do it, and you can report anonymously.
That would be a great tool, I think, for many organizations. Yeah, I think that really would.
Yeah, and one thing we have learned over time, the better ones out there, the better tools for reporting things anonymously, are ones where it allows you to go back to that anonymous reporter and ask some follow-up questions, even if you never know who they are. So it masks emails, it masks IP addresses, things like that, so you can't figure out who it is that's sending. But oftentimes when we get an anonymous report, it's some information but not enough to go on, so we want to be able to go back to that reporter and say, hey, a couple of follow-up questions, a little more detail that we need, if you're willing to provide it. And so that generation tools out there now allow you to do that. So look for
right.
one if you're considering implementing something like that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. We often hear the term the insider, and it's a concern for many company security officers. It's a concern for many CEOs in many cases, but certainly from an IT standpoint, you know, you have a lot of an administrator who's got the keys to the castle, if you will, and has got access to a lot of data, and he or she may have been penetrated by an external third party, or maybe do it for some other reason, you know, be it financial, be it they're in trouble at home, or whatever the challenge may be. Have you seen any cases that have involved, you know, somebody from an individual from inside the organization that has either gone too far or that has, you know, almost carried out an act, but, you know, really somebody from a business, from the business side? Have you seen insider cases like that?
Yeah, we have. And in fact, I was part of another large research effort the Secret Service undertook with CERT at Carnegie Mellon on insider threats to critical information. Insider threats to information systems and critical infrastructure sectors. So major sectors where you know, this is really the infrastructure of the entire country, where there are threats from insiders to their information systems and to other critical aspects within those infrastructures. One of the things that we saw in that research is that insiders, whether they're being motivated and paid for by some external organization and they came into the organization with ill intent, or if they are an employee who had been doing well but all of a sudden didn't get the promotion they wanted, started to have some grievances, had some personal financial stress, and was looking to do harm to the company just as an individual, they follow the same behavioral pattern that we talked about before. So instead of a pathway to violence, it's sort of a pathway to sabotage. But again, we saw starting with an idea, developing a plan, acquiring the tools or the means to carry out that plan. So, you know, for system administrators, it was planning Trojan horses and time delayed cyber bombs and doing things that could disrupt system or allow them access after hours, unmonitored through fake accounts, things like that. So we often think about protecting from the malicious insider just from a cyber standpoint, but the reality is these are employees who are operating among other employees, and we can look at their behavior offline as much as we can look at what they're doing online to see if they may be posing a threat to the organization.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because when you think about if an organization's considering, you know, putting some kind of program together to, you know, they shouldn't just think physical threats.
Absolutely.
They should also think, you know, those information channels or information that could be stolen or passed along to, again, a third party, be it, you know, government entity or, you know, some kind of, you know, some kind of business that's looking to gain, you know, your IP.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've seen insider threats run the gamut. So they've done it for personal reasons to embezzle money from a company because they were under financial stress. They've stolen intellectual property because they felt it was theirs, not the company's. They've engaged in espionage, corporate espionage, national espionage.
Right.
They've deliberately destroyed or damaged critical systems so that they could come in and then be the hero and fix those systems, find the problem and look like they were more valuable to the company than they felt like they had been treated as such.
Right.
There are a lot of reasons why people do this, and then also engaging in physical violence as well. So when an employee raises some concern because of things they're saying to other employees, because of how they're reacting to management or supervision or discipline because of things they're posting on social media, whatever it is that first raises that concern, that red flag, you can look at what they're doing and think both about, are they thinking about and planning for physical harm, or are they thinking about and planning to do something that could sabotage the company reputationally, financially,
right,
intellectually, anything like that?
Yeah. Yeah, you have to have eyes and ears everywhere nowadays. But I think that system that we discussed, and be it, you know, whether it's a workplace violence system or it's some other program, you know, it really does cover a wide group in terms of what it can look for with the variety of different threats. I think that's valuable for listeners to understand.
Yeah, let me actually key off of one thing you said there, too. It's very important to have eyes and ears everywhere in terms of people reporting concerns, but also one thing that really makes for safer organizations, whether you're talking workplace or college, university, school, anything like that, is really to have a what we call a a culture of care or a safe climate, a climate that feels supportive to the people who work there or the people who learn there. So when we have worked with a number of workplace threat organizations, whether it's threat of insider sabotage, whether it's threat of violence, oftentimes we'll see that this is a corporation that, for some reason is in distress. They're going through downsizing. They've got layoffs or RIFs. They've got a lot of turnover. They've got, oftentimes we will see there'll be one or two individuals in management who have a management style that is authoritarian that is preferential to certain employees, and so other employees feel like they can't get a fair shake. When you've got a climate that feels fair, doesn't matter who you raise a concern to, it's going to be treated fairly, that you can voice your opinion and concern, that you're treated with respect by your colleagues as well as by your supervisors, et cetera, that's a climate where we see a lot fewer behavioral problems crop up that typically have fewer less turnover, fewer behavioral issues, fewer physical security issues. We also see that translate into things like fewer sick days for individuals and more productivity.
Wow. Yeah.
So something like that we often don't think of when we think about safety and security is something that can actually have a big impact. So efforts that management, that HR, that your employee assistance program can start to think through about how do we get a sense of how this place feels to work here? What's the climate like and how can we improve it? That can go a long way toward enhancing security as well.
Yeah, we see that in the crisis simulation exercises that we run, and we'll often end the session and go around the room and ask the question, what's the one or two main benefits you're going to take away, or what did you get out of today? And you go around the room, but often we'll get some individuals who have not been part of the process before. Maybe they're new to the crisis team, but they'll say, listen, I've got to go back to my group and I've got to share this awareness, because my group will be happy in the knowledge that we are doing something regarding this particular risk or regarding crisis management in general or preparing for events. And so you often hear individuals talking about their teams and saying, I think they'll benefit from this as well, both from a knowledge standpoint, but also they'll feel confident in the fact that as an organization, we are getting ready for something, whatever that may be, cyber, be it physical, be it natural disaster, whatever the subject may be. So I think that a tremendous benefit when you're either the programs that you're discussing or the training and exercise that we conduct, have that benefit throughout the organization. And if you can share those experiences, I think everybody feels much more comfortable from the CEO down.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think the type of tabletop exercises, preparedness exercises that you all do are absolutely vital for an organization to go through, because they show you where things are working well and they show you where things need to be enhanced before you have a critical situation where that could make or break how you respond. And I think it allows for people to share feedback and to have those observations in a way that's kind of safe and allows for discussion, and then they can bring that back to their teams about, hey, this is what we're doing. I never knew, but we are doing this and this and this, and that can make employees feel much safer than they did previously.
Sure. I remember we worked on previously, you had run a session, I think it was down in Florida at a large community college, and you had run a scenario for them. I believe you were using one of our tools at the time to deliver that. Why don't you talk just for a few minutes about your experience with running scenarios at the end of your training courses? I believe that's certainly something that you do in terms of scenario planning as part of your services that you provide.
Yeah, we often do. And in this particular case, I was thrilled that this community college, one of the largest in the country, actually had requested a chance not only to go through training to learn how to handle threat assessment, but to go through some rigorously run tabletop exercises that you and your colleagues helped to facilitate for us. And it allowed for them to see, okay, we learned how to do this, and we got to practice it a couple of times, but we did this scenario in essentially real time with our real role. So not just talking about now it's up to me to do it. Yes, it's a hypothetical, but I have to be responding now as if it is, and to have the kind of tools that, that you all have to make it feel as real as possible, and to have things all of a sudden some new piece of information comes in and it changes the equation. And so how do you respond to that? How do you reassess? Right. How do you do safety planning from that point forward? Can be such a, an impactful tool, whether you're talking about threat assessment or active shooter drills or any type of preparedness. It can be a wonderful tool to really kind of shake off the cobwebs and see, hey, we are doing this well. We need to tweak this, this, and this, but we actually have a good working system in place.
Sure. Yeah, and I think that's the challenge for many organizations, that they'll implement a program. Maybe they'll test that program initially, and then the challenge always seems to be for them to continually It's not just about the update, but it's a continual improvement process whereby we continually get together and talk about the various different challenges, and we challenge ourselves as a team to improve. So it's an ongoing cycle, and certainly the size portion of that is, you know, again, in the fields that we work, is very important. So it's good to hear that. But that still happens, or that you're certainly doing that in your field as well. I just want to, as we start to wrap up here, Marisa, where does this go in terms of what's the future look like for assessing physical threats and managing them? What does it look like? Is it technology? Is it continual education? You know, is it identification of the various, you know, tools that work for one organization that may not work for another? And we've spoke briefly. You mentioned there's different standards that are a good framework to go off. But what does the future look like from your standpoint? And where is this heading?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we've seen is that in the past 3 years, we have seen such tremendous consensus develop across all these different fields, workplace violence prevention, schools, campuses, even the military. After the first Fort Hood shooting, the Department of Defense convened a task force through their Defense Science Board that looked at every existing tool, strategy, process for predicting violence, for preventing violence. They even looked at emerging technologies like retinal scans, saliva swabs, and they came to the conclusion that the best available tool or practice to prevent violence in the military workplace for them is threat assessment or threat management, behavioral threat assessment, behavioral threat management. So I think we've seen tremendous consensus develop in a very short period of time about just how useful this is across all these different domains. And the challenge right now is really getting the right people trained. So we've got some corporations, some schools, some colleges that a lot of them have stood up teams because they've heard this is the right thing to do, but they don't have the right training. So I think if we can make good quality behavioral threat assessment training widely available, that's going to help us get the curve in terms of preventing active shooter situations like we often see. One key piece of training that we're starting to really try to push for now is to get this training as well for local law enforcement.
Right.
Federal law enforcement is often trained in how to investigate threats and prevent violence. Local, even state law enforcement, often don't have that same type of training. So the more we can get that out there through, you know, things like you know, FLETC, the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, often does free training for state and local law enforcement to do it through National Institutes for Justice, things like that, to get more of this training out to people who are on the front lines of this problem and can use it. And they really help change their mindset from thinking about how to react to something bad that's already happened to how to investigate some behaviors in advance and prevent something from getting to the point of violence.
Thank you. Well, this episode has just been really, really good. I want to thank you. Thank you for this. Before we sign off here in a few minutes, do you have any final comments or for our listeners? And in addition to that, as we start to wrap up, where can they get a hold of you and your colleagues at Sigma?
Sure. Let me just leave the takeaway I'd love for people to leave this session with is understanding that it doesn't matter. We all see the news these days about active shooter situations, about terrorist-inspired violence within the U.S., and it's scary to see, and it can feel overwhelming. But the reality is that it is quite feasible to prevent this type of violence, targeted violence, individual active shooters, even the terrorist-inspired violence, if we know to look for this behavioral pattern. So I hope that people leave the session today feeling more hopeful about all the things that we can do to identify if someone's on the pathway to violence and get them off that pathway to violence and keep them off. For my colleagues and I, we can be reached. The company, again, is Sigma Threat Management Associates. Our website is sigmatma.com. So it's sigmatma.com. You can find all of our contact information there. We're on Twitter at sigmatma. I'm on Twitter at Marisa Randazzo, and we'd love to hear from folks and help out wherever we can. And Rob, it's always a pleasure working with you and your colleagues, and I was delighted to be able to be a part of this today.
Thank you. Well, again, thank you for your time, and I just want to wish you a wonderful holiday season, and hopefully we'll be talking again in the new year.
Thank you.
Take care. Thanks.
Bye.
Well, that's it for episode 6. I hope you really enjoyed the interview with Marisa. I think it was a really good one. And if you did, then as usual, please share the podcast. And if you know people that would like this information, please forward it along. Also, we have lots of informative information in our bi-monthly newsletter. So sign up for that if you want. You can go to preparedx.com/connect. Also, you can check out our blog there, which is, again, preparedx.com and that is /blog. If you're interested in our digital products or services, we have a lot going on, and that can all be found out over at preparedx.net. So we have two main websites, we have .com and .net. A ton of stuff going on there. Please feel free to go over and take a look. And that's it. Until next time. Hope you have an enjoyable day wherever you are in the world. Take care.